Well, hi, Mariam.
Hey, Meredith.
Happy Ramadan.
Thank you.
Although there's a particular greeting, isn't there?
Yes, Ramadan Mubarak.
And what does that mean?
Well, Mubarak means blessing. So Ramadan Mubarak means a blessed Ramadan.
Can you tell me more about why this is a period of blessedness?
So this is the month in which the Quran was revealed to the Prophet Muhammad, and fasting during Ramadan is also one of the key pillars of Islam. So you have the Shahada or declaration of faith, prayers every day, giving to charity or zakat, fasting during the month of Ramadan and going on the pilgrimage to Mecca for Hajj. So yeah, Ramadan is one of those key pillars, and you find that a lot of Muslims, you know, they might not pray, they might drink alcohol, they might not eat halal, but you find during Ramadan, a lot of people really do fast and they give it a go.
Right. So it's a period of really heightened yes. spirituality for many Muslims.
Yes, that's right. It's not just about giving up the food and the water. It's about getting closer to God.
I've just been to my first iftar. And how about this? As I was leaving, Mujgan, my host, gave me a box of chocolates, which she said was payment for the rental of my tea.
Oh, my gosh.
And apparently that's a Turkish custom that you repay your guests for coming around and helping you
to eat. It's very generous.
Yeah, to eat your own food.
Yeah.
So that was a really wonderful experience for me. But I suppose iftar is a pretty routine part of your life at the moment, Mariam.
Yes. So when the sun sets, I'm breaking fast on some dates, soup, usually salad as well, traditional Lebanese food, and my favourite, a cup of tea at the end of the day, which is what I'm craving the most actually during this month.
And how is this something that's important to you, spiritually speaking?
I think for me, when you're depleting yourself of food and water, you're kind of filling up your soul instead. Hmm. So it really grounds you and it humbles you to realise what is important in life and how blessed you are in having readily available food and water at your fingertips, really. So for me, yeah, it's important because it allows me to get closer to my faith.
And breaking your fast each day, you mentioned really craving a cup of tea.
Yeah.
But is that something you do mainly with your family or your friends?
Usually on weekends, it's with my wider family. On the weekdays, it's just with my immediate family at home. But also, you know, you do break fast with friends. A lot of people go out to restaurants and restaurants have iftar banquets that they have. And there's also community events as well. So in the suburb of Lakemba, which is in southwest Sydney, they have these Ramadan markets where all the restaurants kind of have a food truck or a food store at the outside of their shops. And it's a really lovely atmosphere where people come and eat, you know, a potato on a stick or some corn in a cup or, you know, a kebab if they're after something larger. It's about, you know, meeting up with your friends and family and being in the presence of other people.
And Mariam, am I right to think that one of your friends, a novelist, has just won a New South Wales Premier's Literary Award?
Yes, Dr. Michael Muhammad Ahmed. He won the Multicultural New South Wales Award for his book, The Lebs. It's about a young Lebanese-Australian man who's kind of navigating the world post 9/11. And yeah, it was a great win.
And how did you first meet Muhammad?
I met Muhammad when I was about 20 years old. I was working at a community organisation and we were sub-editing like journals, poetry, other pieces of writing. And then we did the same thing when he founded his organisation called Sweatshop. But we were also doing writing workshops at schools. So we would go in and talk to the kids about what they were seeing in the media, getting them to write stories. And we were trying to, you know, tell them, to encourage them that their story was worth telling, and getting them to write their own lives, to represent their own selves instead of having other people do that for them.
And that's something Michael Muhammad yes. himself has been doing with this new novel, The Lebs, isn't it?
Yes, that's right. So Muhammad would say it's not about positive stories about the community, it's about accurate stories from the community. And I guess that's what he was doing with The Lebs. And yeah, I met up with him recently to chat about the book and about his Ramadan experience. So I joined him post-iftar and I asked him what the win meant for him.
You know, if you spoke to most Arab Australian and Muslim Australian writers in this country, we collectively agree that there's a desire through our work to offer complex, positive and sophisticated portrayals of who we are in an attempt to counteract the many negative stereotypes that are often propagated about us in mainstream Australian media and politics. And I think that, you know, winning these kinds of awards, it gives us a sense of hope that people are listening and that people are reading our work, they're engaging with our work, and that they're taking steps towards thinking in a more intellectual way about what it means to be an Arab Australian Muslim in the year 2019.
Well, it was certainly very well deserved and a great read. The main character, though, in the Lebs, Bani Adam, he is a Lebanese Australian. He is an Alawite Muslim, a young man growing up in the western suburbs of Sydney. Mohammed, you're Lebanese Australian, and you were raised Alawite Muslim. Not many people would know what Alawite means or what they believe. So could you explain that?
Yeah. So firstly, it's important to differentiate me from the character Bani Adam. Bani Adam is an autobiographical version of myself, but he's firstly myself at a young age, and he's also a fictional version of myself. So I don't believe what Bani believes, and I don't think what Bani thinks. I mean, the character of Bani is very similar to what I was like when I was growing up, and, you know, as a young Arab Australian Muslim Alawite who was studying at Punchbowl Boys High School, which was a public school but predominantly Muslim Australian students. And I try to take great pride in my Alawism as a young boy, and I try to instill that in the character of Bani, that he's proud of his Alawism as a minority in a Muslim Sunni dominated space. But for me now, which is quite different to Bani, is that I genuinely don't identify with any of the sects in Islam. I don't like to say that I'm Alawi, Sunni or Shia. I stand very firmly, and this is a decision I made about 10 years ago, to say that I'm a Muslim. I believe in the message of the Prophet Muhammad, sallallahu alaihi wasallam, and I'm really happy to look at all the schools of thought that were introduced to the religion of Islam after Muhammad died, and that as an intellectual, critically conscious being, I am free to read the Quran and interpret it in a way that makes sense to me and to live by it based on what makes sense to me. Now, in terms of what is Alawi, it's really in the name. The name Alawi is named after the Imam Ali, and so we are a branch of Shiism. And what we believe in is primarily the teachings of the Imam Ali, who was the son-in-law and cousin of the Prophet Muhammad. He was also, for Sunnis, the fourth caliph, and for Shia and Alawi, the first imam of the 12 imams.
So, Mohammed, growing up, you lived with most of your dad's family in inner city Sydney, in a suburb that was predominantly white called Alexandria. What did you know about Islam or being Muslim as a young child?
The suburb I grew up in, you know, it was in the 80s and early 90s. And it was still a working class community, but also there was the kind of presence of the waves of migration that had been taking place over the last 100 years in Australia. And I do think that growing up in a community that's primarily white disconnects you from your culture and your history, and it disconnects you from your religion or the religion of your ancestors. And so we knew we were Muslim growing up. When I say growing up, I mean up until I was 10, up until we moved from the suburb of Alexandria. We knew we were Muslim. We knew how to speak a little bit of Arabic. We knew not to eat pig meat, and that was a big thing for our parents to instill in us because they didn't want us to accidentally eat pig meat in school. And so they had to warn us, you know, make sure that you check what's in the food. Don't eat at the sausage sizzle, those kinds of things. But other than that, we didn't have any really serious engagement with Islam until we moved to the suburb of Lakemba.
And what was different about Lakemba?
You know, Lakemba had such a reputation of being so heavily Arab and Muslim, and specifically Lebanese at the time, that we nicknamed it Lebkemba. And, you know, when you move into a community where literally every family in your street is Muslim, you know, Sunni, Shia, Alawi didn't make a difference. It's incredible how quickly you transform, you know, because my parents raised us in a primarily white working class community and instinctively said, Muhammad, your name is Michael. And then the minute we got to Lakemba, I remember all the kids were saying to me, why is your name Michael? How do you say your name in Arabic? I say, Muhammad. And they said, that's Muhammad. And so not even 24 hours after I'd come to Lakemba, I remember just immediately identifying with the name Muhammad, and that became my name. And I remember within the first week of living in Lakemba, starting to say Assalamu Alaikum, starting to greet people in the street and greet my mum and dad with the ancient Muslim way of saying hello to someone. And I can honestly say that that year that we moved to Lakemba was also the year that we began to fast. In that same year, me and all my siblings were ready to participate in the holy month of Ramadan, which meant that we were willing to fast from sunrise to sunset for 30 days. Just to try to put this into perspective, that was back when Ramadan was in the middle of summer.
I remember that.
Yeah. Yeah, we were very young. And so we break our fast at 8 p.m. And so you get to a point where you're just beyond hunger. You're just so hungry that your body goes into a totally different state. And it's also very hot, you know, 30 days of no food or water in the hottest period of the year. It almost sounds horrifying. And I think a lot of non-Muslim listeners are like, that sounds intense for a child. But what you need to understand is that I think it's harder actually not to fast when you're living in a Muslim community, because you're surrounded by other Muslims who are all fasting.
So there's a bit of pressure.
Well, I don't remember pressure. Like, I don't remember being bullied into it. I just was embarrassed to eat around my Muslim brothers and sisters. Like, I'm like, I'm not going to fast today. And then I go to school and I'm like, I'm going to buy a Coke. And I just look at all my Muslim brothers and sisters, these, you know, 10-year-olds with, you know, eight of them are named Muhammad like me, and they're not eating. And when you're in that community, you're not feeling bullied or intimidated to do it. You just don't want to betray them or let them down. You want to participate, you know? It's a very encouraging to be in that space. And so I think it makes perfect sense that for me, my Islam really didn't kick off until I was living in a community where there were other Muslims, because you feel that sense of solidarity, which helps you get through the day.
You mentioned solidarity. Was there any friction over the fact that you were an Alawite family moving into a predominantly Sunni suburb?
So firstly, what I would like to say is that one of the ways that Alawiyi, because there's such a small minority who are historically persecuted in the Arab world, one of the ways that my family and other Alawites protect themselves is through anonymity, through not being publicly outspoken about the fact that they're Alawi. So in that way, because my family actively taught us not to talk about being Alawi, we often felt quite safe. Now, there were some instances where our Alawiism revealed itself. But you have to understand, there's some myths about Alawis. One of the strongest myths is that we endorse alcohol, that we think it's not haram. That's not true. There's just, unfortunately, a lot of Alawites in Australia today who drink. And they don't do it saying, I drink because it's okay. They do it as young people who actively don't want to practice what the Quran is telling them. And so when we first moved to Lakemba, and because we'd come out of this very working class non-Muslim community, it was not uncommon for our relatives who lived in Lakemba, because our whole generation moved to Lakemba, it was not uncommon for them to drink and to put beer bottles at the front of their houses, you know, after Christmas and things like this. And so I remember at school, some of the Muslim kids would say to me, you aren't Muslim. And I say, why are you saying this to me? And they would say, you know, we were walking past your uncle's house, bro, and he's got beer bottles out the front of his house. I remember going to my dad and saying to him, why are the kids telling us we're not Muslim? And my dad would say to me, there's good reasons for some of your Muslim brothers and sisters to feel that way, because unfortunately, some of our relatives are not participating in Islam. And it is giving off the impression that we're not practicing. For me, I don't drink. As a Muslim who comes from an Alawite history, I do my best to follow the rules of the Quran. And I think it's really important when we're looking at the Alawi religion, the religion of Alawites, not to mix up what Alawites believe with what Alawites don't know.
You've mentioned that you don't drink now, but there was a point, I believe, in your younger years when you did. And you've written about an incident in high school where you went to break fast with your friends at a restaurant, but instead of doing that, they wanted to smoke some marijuana, and it marked a real turning point for you. Can you tell me what happened?
So this story that you're describing is an autobiographical piece from a book published by Alan and Unwin called Growing Up Muslim in Australia. And I wrote an essay in it called On Being Michael and Muhammad. And in this particular story, I reflect on the last couple of weeks of my time at Punchbowl Boys High School. We went to a school that was surrounded by barbed wires and cameras. So that kind of pressure, of course, is going to result in some very common antisocial behavior. And we talk so much about, like, look at how Alawites behave and look at how Shiites behave and look at how Sunnis behave. In the group that I hung out with, there were Sunni, Shiite, and Alawite boys. And they were all across the board participating in problematic and anti-Muslim behavior. They were all drinking alcohol, you know, underage drinking. So that's not just illegal in Islam, that's against the law in Australia, you know. But it's not uncommon in any community to have underage drinking. And of course, there were some of the boys who could get their hands on marijuana and who would smoke marijuana. And I do remember very vividly that in the final days of our time at high school, which happened to be the same time as Ramadan, the boys and I were going out after we broke our fast, getting drunk, smoking weed, you know, smoking cigarettes, and basically destroying our bodies. And what happened was, there was one incident where I drank so much tequila, I was 17, that I passed out, and my friends carried me home and left me on the doorstep of my home. And I remember being on the bed and throwing up. You know, my dad had picked me up, put me in the bed, and I was throwing up. And my dad was sweeping up my vomit, and he was saying in Arabic, "Ya aibashum alek," which means shame on you. And I remember very vividly having that epiphany, the moment of realization that I had basically gotten to a very, very low point in my life. And I promised myself, when I woke up the next morning, I promised myself that I would never smoke cigarettes or use any kind of drugs or drink alcohol ever again. And I never have.
On RN, that's the novelist Michael Muhammad Ahmed talking to Mariam Shahab about what his faith means in practice. From growing up as Michael in a white working class suburb and then moving to a predominantly Muslim one and becoming Muhammad, weighing up his Alawite heritage, embracing the Quran, and rejecting his teenage excesses. And isn't that exactly what Soul Search as a show is curious about? How is our faith shaped by our experiences? And how in turn does it ground us? What's the relationship between our spirituality, our sense of ultimate things, and how we do life? I'm Meredith Lake, and you can always join me to find out by streaming Soul Search from the RN website or subscribing to the podcast via your favourite app. Well, for Michael Muhammad Ahmed, his experiences of faith in life provided raw material for his work as a writer, and in particular for his novel, The Lebs, which explores some of the identities that emerged after 9/11.
So The Lebs is a semi-autobiographical novel, or a genre that we call autobiographical fiction. So it's based on my real life, but it's a fictionalized account. And so I take a lot of liberties. You know, I change names, I change places, I change incidents, I change events. So it's really important to engage in the work as the creation of art. I don't think it should be ever seen as an account on who I am. It should be interpreted as an interpretation and an investigation into a phenomenon called Leb. And the reason why I consider this a phenomenon is because I think usually people consider the term Leb to be shorthand for Lebanese in Australia. But the group that I was growing up around, they were from Sunni, Shiite, Alawite backgrounds, and they were also among us people from Christian Arab backgrounds. And there was, in addition to all of this, diversity in the countries that we came from. You know, there were people from Lebanon, their parents were from Lebanon. There were people whose parents were from Palestine, Iraq, Afghanistan, Jordan, Syria. There were people even whose parents were from Indonesia. And yet this entire group of Muslims and Christians from various denominations from all over the world used to collectively identify as Leb. And so this was a very unique identity which had emerged pr- primarily after the 9/11 attacks in the western suburbs of Sydney as a way of referring to a new kind of other, which was, I think, the embodiment of the way we imagined the Arab and the Muslim threat. And not only was the media really honing in on the term Lebanese and using it interchangeably with Arab, Middle Eastern and Muslim, but we also saw the community itself collectively identifying as Leb. So I don't think of it as shorthand for Lebanese, and I don't think of it as an Arab identity. I consider the idea of the Leb as a unique Australian identity, and it's hybrid. And what I mean by that is that it takes a whole bunch of different identities and it blends them together. You see a type of underclass Australian masculinity in the Leb performance. And then you see a type of Arabness, you know, language, you speak Arabic, but it's very colloquial to the western suburbs of Sydney. Most people in the Middle East don't understand what the hell we're saying to each other. And then you also see the kind of performance of African-American ghetto gangster, you know, Hollywood narrative. All of those elements come together and they create this brand new creature, which in my book and, of course, in my research, in my doctoral research, I call Leb.
Mohammed, I'm wondering what you hope young Arabs or young Muslims like your son Khalil will take from reading it.
Heaven forbid my son ever read my book, because I would be very embarrassed by a lot of the things that I've written in it. I hope that he gets to grow up in a world where he firstly isn't subjected to the kind of racism, bigotry, discrimination, xenophobia, Islamophobia, and white supremacy that we were subjected to growing up in Australia as a minority. And similarly, I just really hope that my son gets to grow up in a world where he's educated enough, and education is key to this point, where he's educated enough not to be participating in the kind of homophobic, misogynist and violent behavior that so many of my peers were participating in. But what I really wanted to say in the Lebs, in the way I constructed the entire novel, was that the experience of being an Arab Australian Muslim man is complex. I did not want to sugarcoat so many of the problematic aspects of our community. But if you look at the media narrative at the time in which the book is set, if you look at what the media was saying and the way it was pigeonholing us as sexual predators in relation to the SCAF gang rapes, potential terrorist suspects in relation to the September 11 attacks, potential gangsters in relation to the drive-by shooting of Lakemba Police Station, if you look at these incidents and the way the media use those incidents to turn all Lebanese and Arab Australian Muslim communities into a predator, what I wanted to do in the Lebs was create a counter narrative to that, to say there are definitely some antisocial aspects of our community and we should try to understand these. And what I do, I think, which has been very challenging, not for Arab Australian readers, is the way the last part of the book tries to reverse that issue and tries to look at the way in which white Australia demonizes, disempowers, and dehumanizes minority groups, even sometimes when it's happening with the best of intentions.
Mohammed, how do you introduce Khalil to the key pillars of Islam and to Ramadan in particular?
Well, my son is 3.5. And the way in which we have been introducing him, firstly, to the religion of Islam, is what I would like to consider to be a very liberal and secular approach. My upbringing was one in which Islam was expected of me. You must be a Muslim. And to be more specific, you must be a Muslim Alawite. You don't have a choice in the matter. Which, of course, whether our families anywhere in the world like it or not, that's just not how it works. And so for me, I made very conscious choices growing up on the kind of person I wanted to be and the kind of beliefs that I wanted to have. What I do is I teach my son, and his mother teaches our son, everything that we believe and that we value. And we tell him that he's free to participate in these beliefs. And I think that he probably will participate in them until he's old enough and critically conscious enough to decide what is right for him. This is really the first year where he's been asking about Ramadan. He's been noticing that his parents are not eating from sunrise to sunset. And we tell him we're fasting. And we of course, bring him to the dinner table at the time that we break our fast and we do the prayers together. And so he's starting now to identify that there is this ancient ritual that we are participating in. And he's also starting to identify that he wants to be a part of it. So he's been asking me, can I fast? And so I, of course, am not ready, and neither is he, to put him through that process of fasting. But we do fasting activities, you know. So I'll say to him, tomorrow, Friday is our Father Sunday. So tomorrow on Friday, I told him we will fast for 1 hour. And so what we'll do is we'll wake up in the morning and we'll actively avoid having breakfast for a bit longer than usual, just so he understands what it means to fast, that it means not eating. And we also try to have conversations, and this is much more important than the act of fasting itself. We try to have conversations about what fasting means, the cultural, moral, ethical, and spiritual significance of fasting. We talk to him about the fact that there are so many people in the world who are not fortunate enough to have food, and that feeling of hunger for us, you know, living as a middle-class family in the West, is so much determined by when we have time to eat, not whether there is food to eat. We always have food. And that we have a responsibility to support people who are not as privileged as us. And we have a responsibility to look after the blessings that we're given, you know, that we don't waste food.
Can you hear how loud it is? Hello.
Okay, you want to try it?
Yeah.
You can say, Salaamu Alaikum. You say, Salaamu Alaikum.
Salaamu Alaikum.
What's your name?
Khalil,
how old are you?
3.
What's your favorite book?
It's fun.
What's it called?
Allah Tells Me.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. So this is one of the books we read in Ramadan. Isn't it, Dad?
Yeah.
Okay. Allah is my Lord and is all-knowing. In the Quran, Allah tells me to make?
What?
Remember that word? It's Shahada. To declare. All right. What's this?
A map.
And what's it a map of?
The mosque.
Hey, what are these people doing, Khalil?
Praying?
What's this guy reading?
The Quran.
Good boy. In the Quran, Allah tells me to fast in the month of Ramadan. What are they?
Food.
When I am thirsty and hungry, I am grateful for all the blessings Allah has given me.
I love this book.
I know you do. You're silly.
I know it's really important for you and your wife, Jane, to read to Khalil every night. Reading, literacy and storytelling is something that you're really passionate about. And you've turned that passion into your organization, Sweatshop. What is Sweatshop and what is its purpose?
So just to be very clear, Sweatshop is not a movement for Muslims, nor is it a movement that is built on Muslim doctrine. But it just so happens that so many of the philosophies of Sweatshop relate so heavily to my history and my tradition, because different prophets throughout history are said to have had miraculous powers. And usually the powers they're given are meant to in some way represent and embody the period. So the stories of Moses, or who we call Musa, are stories about a person who lived in a time where magic and magicians were prominent, and that was one of the main ways that the faith of the time was enacted. And so when we look at the Prophet Muhammad, what we say is that he lived in a time where what was elevated, what was given a lot of status and cultural value, was poetry, was language, and was storytelling. And so Muhammad, at the age of 40, we're taught, goes to the cave of Hira to meditate. He is visited by the archangel Jibreel, the angel Gabriel, who tells Muhammad that there is a message from Allah. Read in the name of your Lord who created humankind from a clinging clot. Read, for your Lord is most bountiful, who taught humankind by means of the pen. Taught humankind that which they know not. And so Muhammad comes down from the mountain blazing with poetry, which today we call the Quran. And it's that poetry that is the miracle of Muhammad. Now, to really appreciate the value of that, the illiterate man, the Prophet Muhammad, who was known to be illiterate, came down from the mountain with the most beautiful poetry anybody had ever heard. And so what we say is that Muhammad's miracle was the miracle of literacy, the miracle of reading. And so it just so happens that so much of my work, it's so heavily built on the ancient tradition of believing in the miraculous properties of literacy. What we kicked off a decade ago in the western suburbs of Sydney was a literacy movement, which was about empowering culturally and linguistically diverse people in the western suburbs of Sydney through reading, writing, and critical thinking.
Michael Muhammad Ahmed, the director of Sweatshop, a literacy movement which is currently based in Parramatta in Sydney. Dr. Ahmed has written about his upbringing and becoming Muhammad in the edited collection Growing Up Muslim in Australia, and his latest novel, The Lebs, just won a New South Wales Premier's Literary Award.